31 now, though. So again, thank you all for joining us. I know there's so much good stuff online and things to do. So thank you for being here. Also, we have this other class 9 o'clock on Thursday. If you know people who might be interested, or you have a show listserv, I know Torah in Motion would appreciate maybe new people who haven't interested aren't interested in the things we're doing here. They'll find that of interest. Okay, that's as always a few comments. I listen in the car when I take my kid, my son, to school. I only have one left in the house, so I always listen to the last class, and I pick up things that I didn't grasp or I didn't understand when I was when we were online. It's hard, you know, with these comments on Reglachas to respond. But I heard from Mel and also someone else who commented about we spoke last class about the menorah and lighting, you know, the double one. And Mel said that the rabbi of Hishul quoted Rabbi Rimon as saying that when you light the oil lamp, you can either light the, what you do with an oil lamp is you have like a lighter or a match, a lighter or a candle, and that's the shamus. But you don't use that after that. You just use it to light it. And you have another shamus that, like we spoke about, the which would be, so you don't get benefit from the light. And that, he said that the Rabbi Rimon said you can light either one first, which I don't understand at all. It would seem to me that when you make the bracha, you should immediately only light the actual candle for the menorah. And then afterwards, you light the other one. If I misunderstood you, well, that's what you said, Mel, but if it wasn't clear, if I misunderstood you, let us know. Now, there's a new thing today. For some reason, lighting candles has become the biggest deal. It began, I think, in the Hasidic world. Every Rebbe who lights candles, it's if it's, for some of them, it looks like it's Ne'ilah, with all the kavanos and everything and all the videos. And now it's not just with them, it's with the Sfardim also. But take a look at the videos and tell me if you see any of them where they light they light the shamus, which really isn't a shamus, but let's call it the shamus. At Shamash, and then light the candle. I'll just show you one because Rabbi Leib sent it, and we're in the middle of a tshuva of Rav Mazuz. So let me just show you Rav Mazuz lighting it, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about, which one is lit first. Let me pull it up here. Got lots of good stuff to show you today. Here you go. But again, even with the Sfaradim, look how they come close and they watch. Let me get the sound on. Oops, sorry. I got to go back. I don't know what happened there. We'll pull it up again.
הגיענו לזמן הזה אמן אני רוצה
So there you see it. And I don't understand how it could be anything else, because if you're making the bracha, that shamus thing, that's not part of the mitzvah at all. That's just like extra. So how could you light that first? That has to be lit, at least that has to be lit separately. Oh, I quickly, I go through some things. Look, I get many emails. Many of you email me. If I think that the community, our little community here as a whole, will find it interesting, I'll share it. And some already for weeks I have it. I promise I got one. Some of you are going to be very upset, but I'm going to say it. The anti-Zionist email I got yesterday. You'll get it next week. But so I just want to share a few more things with you. I was looking through, but I promise, that I'll get to the anti-Zionist email next week. And some of you will be very angry with me, but for giving him a platform, but he raises an interesting point, and I think it's important. It needs to respond to it based upon something I said. I told you we spoke a good deal about the word olam. Now you can impress people by saying that in Tanakh it means eternity, And in rabbinic literature, it means the world. Incidentally, Shama Yehuda Friedman has about three different articles dealing with the development of the word olam. If you don't know who Shama Friedman is, he's Chatab Pras Yisrael, Talmud Mufak of Shaul Lieberman, a great, great Talmudic scholar. I even have a friend in Lakewood, a huge Talmud Chacham. He does Daf Yomi. When he went to Israel, one of the people he wanted to meet was Shama Friedman. Shama Friedman, almost every one of his articles is in Hebrew, but he's American. So you can read up. But I also saw, I just was looking for something else that I'm going to show you soon. And lo and behold, I came across, we saw how Rav Chaim Kanievsky and Rav Mazuz and the Vilna Gaon all say that Adon Olam, it means, not like I thought, eternal world, not like the RCA Siddur has, but it means master of the world, not an eternal master as opposed to a master of the world. Lo and behold, however, if you Google Bein Shnei Olamot, you'll come up with something from the Academy of the Hebrew Language. And they agree with me, Baruch Hashem, that Olam, they have a whole piece here, how Olam, sometimes even in rabbinic literature, means eternity. For example, the expression, Lo Hayu Devarim Olam. That means that this had never happened. It's talking about time. And they also give Adon Olam. So that's nice. Just quickly, someone was smart, caught it fast. When I spoke about Ramosha Feinstein and the Israeli flag from this book of Rabbi Ari Shvat, by mistake, I, instead of saying page 35, I said on 1935. And of course, Ramosha was not around in 1935 in America. Okay, a couple more things. As I'm listening to the talk today from last week, remember I spoke about the Mel mentioned, you know, the hay at the end, and I said you have the cohortative. That's one. And I couldn't remember, like, for example, Eshmara, I will indeed do it. I couldn't remember the other word. The other word's called the Jussev. I remembered it as I'm driving in the car. What does the Jussev mean? So, for example, like the word Yichtov. Yichtov could mean, or Yishmor, Yichtov, he will write, or let him write. You often have in Tanakh, it looks like the imperfect, but it's actually the Jussev, let him. One more thing, or two more things from last week, and then I'll get to something Mel said again. One of you was listening very carefully, at least you emailed me. I was talking about, I gave the whole story about Rebbe cards and everything, and I hold on, let me get out of this picture here. I can close that up, and showed you, we saw this book by William Grossman, that did the interesting things of Tehillim. And I read you from over here. I said, Tmunos, Migdoli, Yisrael, Rashi, Rambam, etc. And someone emailed me. I think maybe he was just listening in the car, or he didn't go back, or maybe he was watching it live. I don't know. And said that that's not Rebbe cards. That's just pictures. And he's right. I wasn't careful that this is talking about what I read you is talking about pictures. And pictures of Gedolim go back. We even have a Sefer, a commentary in the Shulchan Aruch from a few hundred years ago, which has pictures of the Rambam and Rashi. What I meant to read you was the one below it. Mislach shel 30 kartisim. Everyone has a different Gedol B'Yisrael from Moshe Rabbeinu. Oh, I got to see the picture of Moshe Rabbeinu. Until the Gedolei Achronim with the names of their books, their pictures. And also on the other side, Biographia Katsara Banglit, their short biography, their statistics on the other side. So thank you for catching me. Okay, actually, we only have two more things. One of you, Rabbi Yileb, writes to me that Rav Shabtai Sofer mentions that in all matters, like we saw at Adon Olam, you should follow Diktuk. He didn't care what the Paitan said. And really, it's not just Rav Shabtai Sofer. If you look in the Kuzari, in book two, number 78, the Kuzari gets very upset about these Paitanim who ignore Mila'el, Milara, you know, where the accents go, who don't follow grammar. So that's something to bear in mind. But what I do want to mention, because Mel mentioned it, one more thing he mentioned to me was in Yigdal. I'll say one more point about Yigdal, and then unless someone comes up with a great Chiddush, that'll be the end for Yigdal. But before I say what Mel pointed out to me, I just wanted to show you how Yigdal, because this is relevant to what I'm going to show you in a minute. It was thanks to Mel's question that I realized something. I daven with this sitter all the time, but I never noticed this. First of all, Yigdal is run. Yigdal has a formula, like all these PU team. I mentioned it last week, and the Yigdal formula goes. It goes shteit nuot. Yeah, I'll explain to you what this means now. Yateh shteit nuot. Yateh shteit tuot. Tnuot. So what does that mean? Vowels and then yateh. So it goes like this. This is the model. Shteit nuot. Two vowels. Yigdal. Then you have what's called the yateh, or the peg. And that's either a shva or a chataf, and then a vowel. So the second is lo. And then you have two tnuot, him chai, and then you have the ateid, ve yish, and then you have the second tnuot, two tnuot, tabach. And that's how you get it in both the first and the first half, the second half, and that goes throughout the entire thing. Mel pointed out the following, which I hadn't paid attention, which is correct. Hold on. Let me give you the other picture of Yigdal here. He said that we were speaking, and this all started because of Adon Olam, where I made my point that the Paitan intended it to be, for example, Melech and Aira. But he gave another example. You see in this line here, we sing it, Shefa Nevuato Netano, that really this should be Shefa. And this is clear. The only reason why we do it with the accent on the second part is because of the song. The Paitan did not intend it. It should be read, Shefa Nevuato Netano. But then I looked carefully. I never really noticed this. Art Scroll, actually, it has the syntax right, but it doesn't have the meter right. And if you look at the old RCA Siddur, they have it right, and other Sidurim. Really, the word El is supposed to go on this side. It's Shefa, Tutnuot, Nevu, Yateid, Ato, Tutnuot, Neta, Yateid, no El. So the El has to go on this side. Now, I can't remember when we sing it, if we sing it Shefa, Nevu, Ato, Neta, no El, Anshe, or if we put the El the second part. But the way it's divided is incorrect here by Art Scroll. They also make the mistake in one of the other places. They divide it incorrectly. I believe they do. I have to look. I'm not gonna, yeah, here in Lo Yachlif El Lo Yemidato Lo Mimozuato. So take a look later. You'll see that it follows a meter. Okay, enough of this. Let me get my stuff here. We're going to continue with the response to me from Rabbi Mazuz. It's in it's on page two, number Siman Kuf Yod Daled, page 239. But before we get to that, if you recall, we were talking about Beit El. What is the name Beit El? Is that a holy name? Is that name of God? Is that just the name of the place? And it matters because in terms of writing, we know that El is one of God's names, and You can write it, you just can't destroy it, and you can't erase it or anything like that. So can you send a letter? And we saw what Rabbi Mazuz said, and I asked questions about him, that who says that Beit El is a holy name, maybe it's just the name of a place. So for instance, if you have the name Yisrael, the name Yisrael or Shemuel, it has the name of God in it, but it's become a name now. So you don't write Shemuel, an Aleph dash Lamed. It's part of the name. So I raised the questions to Rabbi Mazuz, and then I asked him, if you recall, what about the synagogues that are called Bethel? Clearly, they are named for House of God. So can you write in Hebrew, even in English, if it's the name of God in Hebrew? Can you write it or not? So these are my questions to him. Now, it's not just a theoretical question. Even the Beit El is not theoretical. If you belong to the synagogue, you're going to write it on your check. I wrote it on a check. One of my neighbors was honored. We got this thing called the Beit El Torah Center. in Beit El. It's a big yeshiva, and they come to America. It's a huge dinner. I don't know how they do it. They have all the big machers. They have John Bolton goes and Mike Huckabee, and they get all these people. And my neighbor was one of the people they honored. So I couldn't afford to go to the dinner, but I wrote a check. And then the following year, they came to his house, which is not far from me. Yaakov Katz, they call him Ketzela. He's famous, one of the founders of Beit El. So I wrote another check, and I wrote Beit El. So these checks are destroyed. So is it a problem? The Rosh Hashiva Beit El is Rav Zalman Melamed. His son is Rav Eliezer Melamed from Har Bracha, who writes the famous book Panini Halacha. Okay, but before we get to Rav Mazuz's reply, I want to just get to the question of mentioning God's name Bichlal, because Moshe raised this a couple weeks ago. Can you, we're quoting Psukim, and I'm quoting from a Pasuk, and I'm saying God's name. I just said it also. So what's the halacha? Moshe sent me, he looked into a few things, because I said that if you're doing half a Pasuk, turns out it's not just half a pasuk. Even if it's a unit, it's okay. That's what I thought. He did all the research, and lo and behold, it's correct. But even before I was correct, but even before that, I was thinking as I knew it was. So let me just show you why I'm saying this. Here's a sitter. What do we say when we lift the Torah? V'zos Torah Asher Asa Moshe Bnei Yisrael Al Pi Hashem Biyad Moshe. Al Pi Hashem Biyad Moshe is not a complete pasuk. It's a partial pasuk. And yet, that's the proof that everyone cites, that there's other proofs as well, that you can, if you're citing a portion of a pasuk, you can say Hashem's name. What about just in general, in learning, things like that? You can find in Yechava Das of Rav Ovadia Yosef in volume... what volume is this? 3, number 4, number 13. He raises this question. If you're learning Gemara and God's name is mentioned, you have a pasuk, let's say, and you read the pasuk, you mention Hashem's name, and everyone who deals with it concludes that according to halacha, there's not a problem at all. With the bracha, you shouldn't, but with the pasuk, it's no problem mentioning it. Moshe sent me, however, the Stipler says that where Nohag, and I think he's speaking for Ashkenazim here, he says Ro'oi, it's better not to say the names when you're quoting Chatzi Pasuk. But that's, I don't even think that's what we're doing, because we're not quoting from a Gemara, we're reading the Pasuk. The question is, what about in a drasha? The Aruch HaShulchan in Siman Reish Tesvav of Aruch Chaim says you shouldn't say it in a drasha, but others disagree. In general, there's a dispute here between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Sephardim have no problem. They say things like Todah Le'el. They don't believe in using this Kuf Lamed Kel, Kel Adon. Ashkenazim have a minhag not to. It's not really halacha, but certainly in learning, there's no problem. So last class, I heard myself that I said... about the names of God. I wasn't sure if when the Sofer writes it, if he has to actually verbalize it, or it's enough to have just the kavana that he's doing it l'shem mitzvah. And but I went, I found some good svarim on it, and the accepted halacha is that he has to verbalize it. He has to l'kadesh Hashemos b'kavanam yuchedes. It's not enough just to think it, even though b'diavad. Now, and when they write the Shemos, sometimes they will do it all, they'll leave it out. Unlike Tefillin and Mezuzahs that have to be written in a straight line, in the order they appear, I should say, you don't need that. So sometimes they'll leave, the Sofer will leave the Shemos of Hashem, and then he'll go to the mikvah, and then he'll fill them all in. So let's get back to the question now of Rabbi Mazuz and what his reply here is. He thinks that the pshat is, despite what I told you, the Chasam Sofer. Remember, the Chasam Sofer says Unkelus doesn't translate Beis El as Beis Eloha. He just translates it as Beis El. So that shows he doesn't think it's holy. But Rav Mazuz disagrees, and he brings a couple proofs. And one of his proofs is this pasuk. Where did I put it? I believe it's... I hear someone's noise in the back, so if someone is not muted, please mute. Where is it? I'm going to have to get another. Here. In Perek Chafches, if you look in Yud Zion, what does it say? It says that Jacob, this is the story of Yaakov after his dream. He says he was afraid. He says, this is Beis Elokim. This is the house of God. And then what does he call it in Pasuk Yud Tes? He calls it Beis El. So clearly, Rav Mazuz says, and there's another Pasuk similarly in Perek Lamed Hey, where Vayikra Lamakom, you know, he called the place Beis El. So he thinks that that's enough to show that it's it means God's name, and you have to treat it with respect. He says the Yemenites have the practice, therefore, of writing this in one word. So that's what he holds. And as for what about my question, that synagogues, I said, how do you call a synagogue Beit El? Because why didn't the rabbi say anything? He says, no problem calling it Beit El. Because what's the problem? The Mabit, Moshe Trani, he called the name of his book Beit Elohim. That's the name of the book, and you can say it. You can say Beit Elohim if you want, but he says this, you can say this because it's you're allowed to say the holy name if it's relevant to a title or for something. Certainly that's a Sephardic practice. But you can't write it. That's the problem. He didn't understand my question so much. I wasn't clear. Rav Mazuz is saying, yes, you can call it Beth El, just like you can always say, with the Sephardim, you say Todah El. There's no problem. They say it all the time. Ashkenazim may be more machmir, but only a minhag. Ashkenazim also agree. In Halacha, you can say it. But according to Rav Mazuz, you can't write it. You can't even write it the city in Israel. So I do not have the answer. Those of you who, you can ask your local rabbis, if anyone can find an answer and get back to me, how is it that we can have shuls with the name Beit El? Yes, you can have the name of the shul, but then what about every time you send out a newsletter? What about, and by the way, the newsletters sometimes have Hebrew on it. They don't just have English, Beth El, they'll have the Hebrew, and they'll say Beit El, and then people send, that's God's name. I don't, and with this, everyone agrees it's God's name. It's not like the city in Israel. So if someone can come up with an explanation as to how this is permissible and how the rabbis allowed this, because it appears to me it's a problem. There are certain names of God, Tzavakot, there's a whole list of names of God, I think seven, and you can say them. I mean, we're not talking about Shem, Ado and then Shem, but you can say them much easier, but you can't write them. Or I shouldn't say that. You can write them, you can't destroy them. You can't throw them out or erase them. So I don't have an answer to that. It's a problem. Okay. Then I come to the next part of the question here. And for this, I have to give a bit of an introduction. I have a little chair here now to put things at. And this is to take us a little into Trump. And before I explain to the question that I asked Rav Mazuz, I need to show you something. Let me get my papers out here. Oh, yeah, I have so many papers here. It's hard to keep track. Okay. We all know we have Trump in Torah. We learn this Trump bar mitzvah, but we don't always pay such attention to it. But Trump actually can help you understand Ta'amei HaMikra in Hebrew, can help you understand verses. And when I say help you understand, that doesn't mean that we're bound to it. That's what we're going to see in a minute. But we see through Trump an explanation. So let me give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about. Famous ones that I think you all know. Okay, so here's a pasuk in Devarim. We know it from the Seder. What does it say in chapter 26, verse 5, in the middle? It says, you shall recite as follows before the Lord your God, Arami Ovei Davi. Now, what does Arami Ovei Davi mean? If you look in the Pashtanim, they translate it as a wandering Aramean was my father, referring to Avraham. But in the Haggadah Shal Pesach, and here actually in this translation from Sfari, I don't know which translation they use, it has... No, actually, this one has my father was a wandering, a fugitive Aramean. But in the Haggadah, what do we say? An Aramean wanted to destroy my father. Sought to destroy my father. And that's referring to Lavan. Now, if you look at the trup here, Now, here's a tricky thing here, because that line there that goes up there, you look at that I don't know what you call it, even what it looks like, but that quarter circle or whatever, it's confusing because it could be either a pashta or a kadma. At least it can't really, but people look at it, they think it. Now, these are two. Let me show you what these things are in the. So here. You have, for example, here you have kadma. And then if you look up over here, you have pashta. They look the same, right? Most people don't see any difference, but there actually is a difference. First of all, there's a difference in how they look. You see the pashta? The little mark is at the very, very end. And look over here at the kadma. The kadma, it's not at the end. It's, well, it's towards the end, but it's the second to the last letter. So let me now go back to the pasuk. So we see here, Arami Oved Avi. Again, someone's sound is on, if you can turn the sound off. This is a pashta. And pashta is, there's two types of trup. There's what we call the conjunctive and disjunctive. Disjunctive means it's sort of like a stop. Conjunctive means it's connected. This is actually a disjunctive. If it was a connected one, it would be Arami Oved Avi. That would be a wandering Aramean was my father. But it's disjunctive. It's Aramean Oved Avi sought to destroy my father. So you see through the trup the way it should be understood. I'll give you another example here. You got this verse here, Isaiah 43. Kol korei bamidbar. What does that mean? Well, if you look at the King James Version, what do they translate it? The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness. Kol korei bamidbar. However, look at the trup. That's disjunctive. Kol korei bamidbar. And this translation reflects that. Kol korei, a voice rings out, comma, in the bamidbar panu derech. So it's the trup actually teaches us how you're supposed to understand it. I found one more interesting example here. Let me show you. Let's see, what is it? Where did I find it? Ah, here it is, in Bereishis. Here's another interesting example. At least I think it's an interesting example. Where is it? In the interest of time, we don't need to, we'll go right to the one, my question. I'll put this away. Okay, so my question was as follows. We have this pasuk in Bereishis. What pasuk? Where? Chapter 10, verse 21. It says, Ulashem Yulad Gamhu, Shem also had children. Avi Kobene Aver, ancestor of all the descendants of Aver, Achi Yefet Hagadol. What does Achi Yefet Hagadol mean? So the translation we have here is older brother of Yefet, Japheth. The question is it Aver? Is he older brother of Yefet? Or is he the brother, Achi, and Yefet is Yefet HaGadol. Yefet is the older one. Which is it? The brother of Yefet, who's the oldest one, or that Yefet is older? Well, if you look at Rashi, Rashi says he doesn't know. Rashi says he doesn't know if Yefet is the older one or if Aver is the older one. But if you look in the, so my question to Rav Mazuz was, well, I don't see what Rashi's going in the Midrash. What's the problem? What's the issue? Look at the trup. It says, Aviko b'nei Aver, Achi, stop, Yefet HaGadol, brother of Yefet, the older one. The trup tells you that Yefet is the older one. So if it was the other way around, if you wanted to say that Aver is the older one, then it should look like this. Let me show you how the trup. Earlier today, I wrote up this trup to show you what it should look like. Let's see if I can find it on my paper here. Ah, yes, here. This is how the trup should look. You can see it. That would be Achi Yefet, that's the brother of Yefet, end of clause, the oldest one. But it doesn't look like that. It looks like this. Let me show you again what it looks like. You can now see what it looks like. I think you can see it's large enough, yeah. So what's the question? So Rabbi Mazuz answers me simply that what I say is correct, but at the time of the Midrash, they did not have the trup. And he points out, as the Ritva mentions in his commentary on Yuma. Now, Rabbi Aryeh Leib doesn't think that this is the pshat in the Ritva. He thinks that what the Ritva is saying, that in the days of Ezra, but I don't agree with that, and it's not a dogmatic issue. Rav Eliyahu Levita in the Bachor says as follows in his book Tuv Tam. I'll read it to you. He says that he's proven that Ta'amim v'Nakuda lo hayu musamim in otiot ad achar chatimat ha-Talmud. He says that until the end finishing of the Talmud, you didn't have any trup or even the written vowels. Shekamu balei hamasorat asher b'Tveria hamadina v'inziu dot hachachma. So, and I believe that's what the Ritva is saying as well, because he says the Ritva says that now we have trup. So earlier questions of interpretation have been settled for us. I think that's obvious what he's speaking about. But even if he is not, others agree with this. This is an important point, I think, because trup is not determinative in how we have to interpret. We read the trup and we see that the trup teaches us, we can see how the people who made the trup understood it, but that's not definitive. You have plenty of examples where commentators interpret, including the mainstream, Rashi, Ramban, etc., interpret it at odds with the trup. And sometimes the unculus is at odds with the trup. So trup, although we use the trup, and that's what we need to lane, that's our tradition, but trup does not have any authoritative ruling in terms of how to understand the pasuk. Trup is just another interpretation. My understanding, however, before I looked more into it, was that, yes, maybe you didn't have the symbols, but I thought that still the way of reading, we would assume that the Midrash would have preserved this way of reading. And Rav Mazuz, based on the Ritva, thinks no, that this is just the Masoret's interpretation. And the Midrash is not bound by that, obviously. In the days of the Midrash, you certainly would have had people who had said the same thing. You're supposed to read it this way. But others said, no, you read it the other way. So we're bound by trup in terms of how to read, but we're not bound by trup in terms of how to interpret it. And therefore, so if someone says, well, you know what the pshat is, because look at the trup, that's just a pshat. It's not the pshat. The next question I asked him, this is all, again, with like 10 questions in this, is he had mentioned that Rav Avadi Yosef permitted Rav Dov Kook to eat kitnios on Pesach. Who's Rav Dov Kook? Let me show you a picture of him. He's from Rav Kook's family. Sorry, that's not Rav Dov Kook. We're getting to that in a minute. Different, completely different world there. Here's a picture of Rav Dov Kook. He's a big makubal in Tveria. And Talmud Chacham, traditional Talmud Chacham, also was a makubal. But he became a Sephardi, as it were. And Rav Avadia Yosef permitted him to eat kitnio, to do everything. And Rav Mazuz says that that's because he became completely Sephardic. And I wrote to Rav Mazuz, however, that about the letters we saw that Rav Avraham Yosef believes anyone can become Sephardi, and Rav Yitzchak Yosef doesn't believe that. Only a Baal Tshuva could become Sephardi. I don't know how Rav Yitzchak Yosef would deal with the case of Rav Dov Kook. But then I pointed out that book, remember the controversial book, Mayan Omer, where the question was, how reliable is it about Rav Avad Yosef? In this book, it says explicitly that Rav Avadia holds that any Ashkenazi can become, a, even if you're not a Baal Tshuva, you can eat Kitniot, you can become Sephardi. So there you go. And Rav Mazur simply says that, he, in his opinion, Rav Avadya only said this to Rav Dov Kook because he became a real Sephardi. Not only did he adopt all the Minhagim, he pronounces the words like a Sephardi. What does that mean to pronounce the words like a Sephardi? Not just with the ayin and the chet, but the kuf. You can learn to say the kuf. Kuf and kuf are different, and gimel, gimel with the geish, without. If you know how to do that, it's hard to teach an old horse new tricks. Okay. And the final thing I asked him, well, the final thing we're going to deal with was a few times Rabbi Mazuz has spoken, said negative things about the about rabbi doctors. Okay. I don't take it personally. Not only don't appear personally, I even wrote him a letter. And but when I didn't do this, it's not like I'm playing along with him here, what I said. I meant it because I think it's true. I said to him in a few places, you wrote about the rabbi doctors and the troubles they cause. Because there are rabbi doctors who cause trouble. So no question about it. But if I'd be speaking today, the rabbi not doctors are causing more troubles. I mean, you haven't had any rabbi doctors having people daven and have giant weddings without masks and everything. So, but be that as it may, the examples he gave, some of the examples he gave from like left-wing types, at least I think, maybe some of you listeners don't think, I think it's a bit of a problem. One person in particular he went off on is Rabbi Benny Lau. That he doesn't like Rabbi Benny Lau. His interpretations. I like Rabbi Benny Lau, although I don't like his first book on Rav Avadya Yosef. I wrote a review of that because this is supposed to be an academic book and it has an approbation from Rav Avadya Yosef. It's a study of Rav Avadya Yosef. How can you have a study of someone where then you get an approbation? That's not an academic work then. I, in my review of it, I said it's politically correct scholarship. But he has all sorts of interesting stuff and an interesting figure, but there's no question he's on the left. And he said some stuff, which it's basically like open Orthodox type. So you couldn't expect Rav Mazuz to approve of that. What happened was that one of his students is a member of Knesset for Likud. And he gave him one of Benny Lau's books, one of the books on Nana Chazal, a Navi, I think it is. So Rav Mazuz read it, and then he wrote a big criticism of it. Okay, so I wrote that, I'm not referring to Rabbi Lau, but I'm just saying in general, so we have some rabbi doctors who make tzarot. The reason I'm writing this is because I'm the Moritz I want to give him. I think it's a cute Moritz. And then I said, of course, not all of them, and there are great Gedolim who are rabbi doctors, like Israel Hildesheimer, Rav David C. Hoffman, Rav Herzer, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Heller. I said, today there are great rabbis who are doctors, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, Rav Arusi. Rav Lichtenstein was not alive then when I wrote this letter. Rav Arusi, I showed you his picture. He's the Rav of Kiryat Ono. He's the head of the Dar Daim, the Rav Kafech group. He has a PhD from Bar Ilan. He's on the Moetzes Rabbanut Tarashit. But I said I heard a nice Melitza about these troublemakers. So here's the Melitza. So let me show you the Melitza. Let's see, it's in Shmos. So where do I... here it is. So if you look in Lamed Bey's Zion, it says, Vaydaber Hashem al Moshe, it says, Raid Kishechat Amcha. Go down because, the people have dealt corruptly. So Raid becomes, and the Melitza becomes doctor. That is, you can read it, the doctors, they've corrupted things. So whatever, it's a Melitza. I'm just playing, it's a game a little bit, the Melitzas. But his answer is important because he doesn't take it as a joke. He says, but there are doctors who are Yirei Shamayim. In other words, he's upset that I wrote that, even though I thought it was kind of cute. He says, like Rav Yonah Mertzbach. Yonah Mertzbach is one of the founders or early teachers in Yeshivas Kol Torah. Comes from Germany where he had all these rabbi doctors. And he was a great mathematician. In Germany, as we know, you had all the rabbi doctors. That was a big thing because the Reform and the conservative were all rabbi doctors. So the Orthodox had to be rabbi doctors. So you had a lot of rabbi doctors in Germany, including Gedolei Yisroel. Rabbi doctors were a big thing in America too in the 1950s and the 1960s. It was very popular. You had rabbis coming out of YU, they gave a DHL, some got PhDs. It's sort of going out of style, but it was a big deal. And you think it's only YU? Look what I have. I've never published this. You're seeing this for the very first time. I've never written about it. Some of the stuff I share with you, I've written about. You know who else has a doctorate? Here is from Hapardes magazine. Hapardes in, I wrote it down what year it is. Hold on, 1953, I believe it is. I think it's 53. I don't see the page where I wrote it down. 56, I forget what year it is. Hapardes recorded that Ner Yisrael decided they got approval from the government or from the boards that determine these things to award a doctorate. And the whole article was how this doctoral degree from Ner Yisrael is going to help with Harbatzos Torah. And the author says how upset he was at first. He didn't understand it. It's a 3-page article. But as he goes further in fact, let me, I want to, hold on a second. I want to get you the exact date in case you want to check here. I'm going on my Otzer HaChachma here so I can give you the exact date. What year do we say it is? It's Chaf Zion. So year 20, Hapardes is the big rabbinic journal. So year Chaf Zion is, yes, 1953. So it explains why there's a necessity because you have yeshiva students who want the doctorate. And if we don't offer it, they'll go to the university and that'll be a lot of bittul Torah. And this way we can keep them here and they can get a doctorate for just learning Torah. A whole, just like you have the BTL, Bachelor of Talmudic Law. So then you have the Doctor of Talmudic Law. I even met, I don't know how many of these Ner Yisrael had, but I met one. Years ago, before Artscroll had the translation of Shkolim for Daf Yomi, if you wanted to use Daf Yomi, because Sansino never translated it, there was a rabbi at Ner Yisrael, he translated Shkolim, and it was published, and it looks like Sansino, but it's not, and he was a rabbi doctor. I don't know how many they awarded, and you can read the entire article here about how this is a positive thing, because it's going to keep them, it's going to be a kosher degree, basically, because they won't have to go b'diavad because people want the degree, they feel they need it, etc. Therefore, we should have it. So Ner Yisrael awarded the doctorate degree also. So of course, I can go through the list of all the rabbis. It was expected, basically, not required, but it was expected at your Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin that you'd get a doctorate. Now, mind you, I hope I'm not offending anyone, but the doctorates in Germany are not, they're not like American doctorates. You look at these doctorates, some of them are 40 pages, 50 pages, even the Ravs, I think is like 80 pages. These are not American doctorates. In Germany, you can go on to like a super doctorate afterwards when you did a real project. But this is, you could spend, let's say, 2 semesters at a German university, and then you write up, 50 pages, and they award the doctorate to you. We're not dealing with such great chachma, and some of them are interesting, but many of them have no lasting value. For us, part of the value was that as doing doctorates, basically the entire commentary of the Rambam on the Mishnah was retranslated into Hebrew by various people looking for doctoral degrees. Now we don't need that because we have Rabbi Kafach. But then, and then he says, listen to this. After saying that there are doctors who are Yirei Shamayim, he says, almost all the early Sephardim, and he includes the Bala Maor and the Ramban, learned the works of Aristotle and the Greeks, with the exception of the Rif, because he came from Morocco. What he's saying here, and this is something that Rabbi Azuz feels strongly on, that we should not be afraid of Chachma. Chachma is valuable. Of course, you have to understand that Torah goes above. But this extremist Ashkenazic rejection of wisdom, this was never the Sephardic approach. As he says, virtually all the Sephardim learned Aristotle and other Greeks. Well, today, we don't feel like we're getting wisdom from Aristotle. It's more antiquarian interest. Or if you want to understand the Rambam, you read Aristotle. But you just have to substitute. What's the Aristotle today? Who's the leading scientist today? The leading philosophers. So this is not modern orthodoxy, Rabbi Mazuz would say. This is tradition. in the Sephardic world. We know that the Ashkenazic world was not open-minded, and but there's a reason for that, because they were persecuted and they were closed off. But wherever Jews were allowed entree, access into the outside world, they partook. And Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's whole idea is that we never wanted to be in the ghetto. We were put in the ghetto against our will. Jews are supposed to be out there. The model for Jews is the Golden Age of Spain. We're supposed to be involved in civilization and bringing Jewish wisdom to bear. We spoke about this with Rabbi Sachs. So this is not a distortion. This is the mission. Hirsch actually uses the word mission of the Jews. And this, and if you look, you see who Hirsch is. He sees himself as following in that path. So it's ironic here that one of the leaders in the Sephardic quasi-Haredi world, he is like defending the honor of the Sephardim, that no, we're not afraid of Chachma. And it's not just Chachma, as he says in other places. It's Diktuk. For the Ashkenazim, Diktuk is for the Maskilim, Usser. Tanakh, no, that's for the Maskilim, Usser. All these things, philosophy, all Usser. The only thing that you do is Shas and Poskim. No, the Jewish curriculum is much wider than that. And at least from his perspective, you can't be an authentic Talmud Chacham without knowing Ibn Ezra, without knowing the Rambam's philosophy, without knowing Shirei Sfarad, without knowing, because this is all part of it. Granted, some people are going to be more inclined to this than to that. But I hate to say it, but if from his standpoint, and this would make us all Amaratzim, if you don't know Yatei Tnua, what I just showed you about Yigdal and the poetry. These are our great Ibn Gabirol and Yehuda Levi. If you don't know how to read a Hebrew poet with the meter and all these sorts of things, you're also, it's a deficiency. These are important matters. So quite interesting. And the last thing I asked him has to do with just a small point about Rav Eliyahu ben Amozig. We don't need to get into it. It's not that relevant. Okay, the last thing we'll do tonight, we have time for one more. We move to a new person. Fascinating individual. His name is Rav Yaakov Kapel Schwartz. I'll show you a picture of him here. Here's one picture I'll show you. Here he's speaking. This took place just a week and a half ago. So you're asking, well, they're not wearing masks. Of course, you know, unfortunately, Satmar, they don't believe in masks. They've suffered terribly. I can't explain it. I don't know what happened to Pikuach Nefesh. I'll never understand this. Rabbi Schwartz was speaking. I know he kept away. He didn't go to shul. But he ended up getting it also. He has a shul in Borough Park. This is, he's speaking at the celebration. Just like Chabad have their own Yom Tov, Satmar, Chafal of Kislev, is the anniversary of the Satmar Rebbe being saved when he made it into Switzerland. When he crossed into Switzerland on the Kastner train, the Satmar Rebbe was saved by Kastner. I have a new book just came out about the Satmar Rebbe. It's called Hakanai by Menachem Karen Kratz. He's a dentist, but he's a real scholar. I don't know where he finds the time. And he goes to go to the libraries and everything. He also wrote, you can see on tablet, a couple articles on the Satmar Rebbe. And it's very good. The facts are correct. I have to say, though, I don't. Look, there's a lot to criticize in Satmar, no question about it. But he writes in one of his English articles that the Satmar Rebbe abandoned his flock. I don't like using that word, abandon his flock. Abandon has that negative term. Is the Satmar Rebbe obligated to stay and die with his flock? Maybe you'll think so. So lots of people left. But the Hasidim want the Rebbe to leave. That's part of their ideology. The Belzer Rebbe and the Ger Rebbe and the Lubavitch Rebbe, they also left. And the Hasidim want that. For the Belzer Rebbe, someone even took his place and was killed, but took his place as like the stand-in. So the Nazis would think that that's the Rebbe. I don't like saying the abandoned. If someone can get out in those times, I don't think it's, we're not here to judge. But it's the whole history. We're not going to go into it now. You can listen to the old classes. I did on the Satmar Rebbe, the whole Kastner affair, and the Rebbe's views of Zionism. Suffice it to say, there's a lot to discuss, and we can disagree. But Rabbi Yaakov Kapel Schwartz, let me get you a better picture of him. He is Satmar. There he is. There's another picture. This picture was taken last week by someone I know who's in his shul. and he took that picture. He happens to be one of the most interesting Talmidei Chachamim. Who ever heard of a Satmar who's writing for Or HaMizrach, for Hamayan, Zionist journals, who is corresponding with Rabbi Yochanan Adler from YU and other people? And the culture, I've corresponded with him. I only spoke to him twice. I only saw him once. I was at a conference in 2004, which is the anniversary, the 800th anniversary of the Rambam's death. We had a conference. And I see all these, we had all these people coming to hear this conference at the Center for Jewish History in New York. And there's this one guy, you just saw his picture with the long beard and the bekesha, and he had like a gabbai with him. Very much out of place. And he's speaking to Avi Revitsky. Avi Revitsky, unfortunately, not long after that, was hit by, I think it was a bus, and the great scholar of Jewish philosophy and other things. He lived, but unfortunately, he's not able. I mean, mentally, this really did him in. I find out later that was Yaakov Kapel Schwartz. So clearly, we're dealing with someone who's quite unusual. He has anyone who's interested in the Ramban. He has his commentary on the Ramban, not just on the, here you see how thick it is, two volumes, but also he deals with the Piyutim of the Ramban. He has letters, five volumes. He has works on Halacha, etc. But I find this interesting, five volumes of Michtavei Torah. That's where one of his letters is to me, and letters to Rabbi Shalat and Professor Chalamish from Bar Ilan. How Satmar is able to do this? Let me just, before I get to my letter, I was looking for some interesting things, and I pulled off the shelf his book, Likutei Diburim. He has on Parsha. Let me just read you something that he wrote. This book came out, this is volume 2, so it came out in 2016. Let me read to you what he says and ask yourself, if someone else said this, wouldn't people be shocked? But he has all sorts of unbelievable stuff. He knows philosophy. So that's because I was reading his stuff. That's why I thought he's someone I want to correspond with. And as I said, we had a very long conversation one night. You know, their culture is so much different than ours. After we had this conversation, he was marrying someone off, a daughter, I think, a few months later. He sends me a wedding invitation. And he also sent a friend of mine, and he went to the wedding. It's like there's such a tamimus there. As, you know, he enjoyed talking to me, so he wanted to share his simcha with me. We got to pay for every seat. We make a big deal. We have to apologize. I can't invite you because, you know, I have too many. For them, it's just the more the merrier. Just come in. And I was sorry. I would have gone, but I had to be in Scranton that night. But in his volume here, volume 2, Parshas Vayera, he says, this is a different thing I want to share with you, but I'll show it to you. I just pulled it up. He gave an amazing chiddush, I think. Here's his chiddush. Oops. I never thought of this before until he pointed it out. Where are we? The Rambam. Rambam says... In this is Hilchos. Here it says Avel. I actually think it's Avel. Avel is mourner as opposed to mourning. I think we assume it's Avel. This is the Chabad site. But what about the Rambam says anyone who deviates from the path of the community, Parshim Adachi at Sibur, who are they? Anashim Sheparku Ol Mitzvos, those who reject Torah. What are we supposed, and they don't observe the holidays, et cetera, the Apikorsim. What's the halacha? I'll read it in English. We do not mourn for them. Their brothers and their other relatives wear white clothes, rub themselves in white, eat, drink, and celebrate for the enemies they only want to perish. That's the halacha. We don't practice this anymore because we assume that everyone who's irreligious, they don't know any better. But the old halacha is if someone was a non-observant, a public non-observant person rejects Torah, well, they're not our brother in Torah, therefore we don't mourn for them. He says something which I don't think anyone has ever said before. Everyone assumes you don't mourn for them. Let me pull up the screen again. What does Rabbi Schwartz note? What does it say here? He says here that for these people, Ein mitablin aleihem. We don't mourn for them. Ella, but acheihem ushar krovehem, their brothers and their other relatives, you know, they rejoice, they act normal because a wicked person has died. It says that their brothers and their other relatives. He points out in Likutei Diborim, volume 2, page 30, it doesn't say aviyem any imam. It doesn't say their father and mother. And he says that's because, according to halacha, the father and mother are always supposed to mourn their child. He says, HaTorah lo tovat devarim k'neged ha-teva, shetava kadosh baruch hu b'olamo. The Torah does not ask parents to ever uproot this natural love of their children, even if the child is the biggest heretic. You're always supposed to mourn for your child. What's the teva? Rachme ha'avos achabonim. And he says, look at Avraham and Yishmael. I don't think anyone has ever said that before. That when they say you're not supposed to mourn for a sinner, it excludes the parents. And look, and the Rambam's language. He derives this from the Rambam's language. What I wanted to show you, and then we'll probably get to the question next class. The question is, we'll see with Rebecca Kamenetsky. Rebecca Kamenetsky has a radical idea, and we'll see what he says about it. But I found something else I think you'll find interesting, which I hate to say it, but it's true. If some liberal modern Orthodox rabbi were to say something like this, people would be very upset. He deals with a passage in the Gemara. And I see it's 9:26. Maybe we'll go 5 minutes later because I think you'll like this. I'm going to read you the passage in the Gemara now. I thought maybe Art Scroll would do something, explanation. They don't. So I had my brother send me the Art Scroll earlier today. Just listen to this passage. This is in Tractate Sota 49a. Over here, Ravacha. I'll just read the English. Ravacha bar Yaakov reared Rav Yaakov, the son of his daughter, from childhood. It happened once, after the child Rav Yaakov grew older, that his grandfather, Ravacha bar Yaakov, said to him, "Give me water to drink." Rav Yaakov replied, "I am not your son, and therefore I am not obligated to honor you as a parent." Isn't that a strange story? What kind of a way is that to treat your grandfather, even if technically you don't have the obligation? We have all sorts of strange stories. Did I tell you already my theory, my heretical theory about how Talmud is an internal work for the rabbis? Have I shared that in this class? I don't know if I shared it, but let me show you a similar story, and then you're going to wait till you hear what Rebecca Kappel Schwartz has to say. Let's see. I'm just going to read this to you. Here's a story from Tanit. I'm just going to read it, 20b. The sage is further taught in praise of the reed. A person should always be soft like a reed, and he should not be stiff like a cedar. An incident occurred in which Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, came from Migdal Gedor, from his father's house, and he was riding on a donkey and strolling on the bank of the river. And he was very happy, and his head was swollen with pride because he had studied much Torah. Criticism of Rabbi Elazar. He happened upon an exceedingly ugly person who said to him, "Greetings to you, my rabbi." But Rav Elazar did not return his greeting. Instead, Rav Elazar said to him, "Worthless person, how ugly is that man? Are all the people of your city as ugly as you?" The man said to him, "I do not know, but you should go and say to the craftsman who made me," craftsman capitalized, not God, "how ugly is the vessel you made?" When Rabbi Elazar realized that he had sinned and insulted this man merely on account of his appearance, he descended from his donkey and prostrated himself before him. And he said to the man, "I have sinned against you. Forgive me." The man said, "I will not forgive you until you go to the craftsman who made me and say, how ugly is the vessel you made." And then it continues how he walked behind him trying to appease him, etc., etc. You read a story like this and you got to ask yourself, what's going on here? Who would ever say to someone, you don't reply to him, and then you call him ugly and this and that, and then he rebukes him? And this is a big problem. Anyone who learns Daf Yomi, you get to this, what to do with it. So this gets to my quasi-heretical idea, which I know they'll throw me out of the Beis Midrash for saying it, but today we have Daf Yomi, everyone learns this, and that's the problem. I think you see from passages like this and other passages where they criticize the rabbis that they never intended a Talmud to be read by the masses. This was a work by rabbis for other rabbis, and therefore you can understand why they would do a story like that. because they're trying to, rabbis can criticize other rabbis, and they're making a point. The problem is when non-rabbis see this and you ask yourself, but they would never print a passage like this, I think, if they figured we'd look at it, but among themselves, when they want, and the result of it is in the end, Rabbi Elazar realized that he was being arrogant and that he was being cruel. It's not for us to say, the Gemara says it. So I think that we can see many examples of where we see passages that were not intended for the outside world as it is. Incidentally, that's why there was criticism of translating the Talmud, of the Agadic portions in particular, because they say the masses are going to see this and they'll say, oh, what kind of a jerk he is, things like that. They won't understand it. And, or maybe they will understand it, but they're not supposed to because it's not intended for them. I think it's an interesting point, and historically I think it's true that until modern times, basically, Talmud was kept separate for the intellectuals. So we had a similar passage, I just read you, where you have one of the Amoraim saying, why should I get you a cup? You're not my father, I'm not obligated. Rav Yaakov Kapel Schwartz in Yeket Ephraim, volume 5, page 201, he says as follows, after quoting this, he says, this Agadah is Zara Utzmua. It's strange. Because even if you say he's not obligated to respect him from the Ikar Hadin, nevertheless, he's not any worse than a Stam Yehudi Zaken, Shavakish Mayim Mishton. Even if, forget it's your grandfather, if an old Jew, any old Jew, asks you to give him some water, you're going to give it to him. You're not going to say, I'm not going to. And he says, Eliezer asked from Rivka water to drink. And she said, drink, and for your donkeys as well. So what's going on here? How could he do that? And this is what he says. He says, we have to say, we don't learn from this Agada. It's not in our tradition, I guess you could say. It's not something we accept. He says, this is an individual opinion. We're not bound by this. And then he cites the Rambam. Just like the Rambam says about astrology. The Rambam says, hey, you can find passages in the Talmud that support astrology, but we don't accept those passages. They're wrong. What he's saying is, basically, is that we don't accept this Agada, and that this is putting forth a wrong approach to life. We don't like this approach. And ein hechrech klal lomod mehem. We don't have to learn from this. That is, we see this, we find it strange. He says the answer to Agadot, strange Agadot like that, is simply that we don't accept it. Then after saying this, he says, however, certainly what I say are batalim umvatalim, against what the Chasam Sofer says. The Chasam Sofer uses this to learn something else and all the Achronim that brought this Gemara. And he says, so what I said, reject it. But this is a common game. Game is not the right word. A common device that great rabbis sometimes use. They say an opinion, a radical idea, and then they say, but nevertheless, since the great rabbis disagree with me, what I said is batel muvotal, forget it. But if they really meant to forget it, they wouldn't have written it. They write it because they really do believe it and they want it out there. But then in order not to be seen as so disrespectful, they say, nevertheless, my words are batelim uvatelim against the Chasam Sofer and all the others. And I'm just dealing with it. But this is, I think, quite a provocative approach for an Achron, a modern person, not even an Achron, a modern person to say that if we find a Talmudic passage troubling to our moral sense, basic Jewish values, we'll simply say we don't have to answer for it. We don't accept it. We're not bound to every passage in the Agada. Some things reflect ideas that we don't. This is the sort of thing that people would be put in Chayrim in the liberal Orthodox. And here you have Rabbi Yaakov Kapel Schwartz. So we're not going to get to my question and answer. We'll get to that next class. We'll deal with Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who Rav Yaakov really says something radical, and we'll see whether that can be supported. Three questions to Rav Yaakov Kapel Schwartz. We'll get into the issue of Avodah Zarah. Is Avodah Zarah, that Rav Yaakov wanted to argue that Avodah Zarah could have some reality to it, that the world is created in such a way that Avodah Zarah could be like the universe could be structured, that Avodah Zarah actually works. You think that's crazy? You think it's heretical? Wait to see Rav Yaakov's proof for it. But then we'll see what Rav Yaakov Kapel Schwartz has to say. And then we'll get back to Rav Chaim Rappaport. Wait to see what the Baal HaTanya says about what you're supposed to ask us, what a chass is supposed to ask a Rebbe. You think you're supposed to ask a Rebbe everything under the sun? Hardly. And then I don't know if we'll get to it next class, but the lesson which we just learned from Yaakov Kapel Schwartz, which I think is only radical when applied to the Talmud, not when applied to Rishonim, at least not in our circles, when applied to Rishonim, I think we're going to have to use that because we're going to see something in the Torah that is you're going to find it very troubling. And the question is, what do you do with a troubling passage like that? So I see we've gone 5 minutes over, but that's okay, I think, because we had good stuff today. Let me get the questions here. Mel says he was repeating what Rabbi Luben quoted from Rimon's new Sefer. Perhaps the question, but I said that once you light it, once you say the bracha, you should light the first candle. You light the shamash before you make the bracha? You light the shamash, you make the bracha. But then you said that you said you can light any, the shamash before you make the bracha. After you make the bracha, you can light it first. That was my question. Fashela says, many people light the shamash before making the bracha and lighting. Yes, okay, that's true. And that's, you saw Rabbi Mazuz, he's holding what we would call the shamas, the candle. But then there's the second shamas, which is built in to keep away the light, like we spoke about last week. The question is, though, when you make the bracha and you're holding shamas number one, can you light shamas number two first? No, I think my point is, and I thought, if I'm wrong, Mel, I thought that's what you were saying, that he said it doesn't matter if what you light first. I think it's clear you have to light the Hanukkah lights first. Susanna says, is Bethel, Connecticut? Yes. The question is, what does that mean? Rabbi Kelman tells us that Rabbi Weider, who's a great Baal Koreh, in my next blog post, I will be citing him, will be giving a five-part series on Tameh HaMikra. You heard it here first. Yes, Tameh HaMikra is one of those things that very arcane, let's put it that way, and you really feel like it's another world because most people don't know it. And there's all sorts of interesting things and you see it every day. So every time we look at davening, let me just show you one more thing. I forgot to say this because Mel, you reminded me, Mel asked me a question. We're gonna be laning this Thursday. Hold on. On fast days, let me pull it up here. It's in Shmos. No, Friday we'll be laning. Here it is. Mel asked me the following. Why you have sometimes the word kuma? Let me read you his the word kuma, for instance, sometimes it's kuma, and other times it's kuma. So in Hashem's name, it's kuma, Hashem, Be'afutsu, and other times it's kuma. And I said the reason is because of if it's Hashem's name, or I guess even other gutturals, then you make it mila el. And I said it's like the word lama. Lama, if it's before a guttural, it's lama. And that includes Hashem's name, like an Aleph. And if it's otherwise, it's Mila'el, Lama. And Mel pointed out, reminded me, that in the Torah reading this Friday, we will see that. So, for example, look in Pasuk Yud Aleph. It says, Lama Hashem. But look at the next Pasuk, Lama. And it usually is Lama. That's the standard way. But here, because you'd swallow it. If you say, if you said Lama, then Ado, you'd swallow the first letter. So instead, if you said lama, lama, do, shem, it would be swallowed. So instead you say lama, that's why we think it is that the Masoretes did that. Okay, I just bring that up because Mel reminded me. And Mel says, Pashta is always on the tip and Akadma is never on the tip. Right, that was probably before I mentioned that. And that explains why you'll see sometimes the two. It looks like the two Pashtas and the two Kadmas, because that explains it also, because it's telling you that the accent is earlier on, but it's a Pashta. Very nice. Many Bali Kriya, Michael says, make mistake with this, especially in case where the Kadma isn't followed by an Azza. Correct. The Sfaradim, incidentally, they don't call it a... they have different words for it. I don't need to get into that now. Mel is machaving to what Mel said again. Achi Yefer Agadol, but then you have something in Smichut on a disjunctive ta'am. Okay, so maybe Alan, you're correct. I don't know if that could be, but I have to look. You might be able to do that. I don't know. But it's a good point. Then you'd have, but you have to use a different trump. Very nice, Alan. Who determined the trump? Well, the Masoretes, according to the Bachur. However, others hold that no, it goes back to Ezra or even earlier. But I think we assumed it's the Masoretes who did that. It's not because in the case of two Pashtas, one is to tell you that is in fact the Pashta, not Kadma, that is to tell you the emphasis goes. Yes, that's what I said. Thank you very much, Michael. Simcha Kagot published a two volume set on the differences of Baal Mesora as embodied in Trump in many instances of Mforshim and Psukim. Yes, and we have distinctions. We have disagreements. There's Ben Asher and Ben Naphtali as to how, for example, like the word, everyone knows how you pronounce Yisachar, right? Yisachar, Yisachar. Well, that goes back to a dispute. Ben Naphtali had it differently. We have other things. Someone says my sound is not as good as tonight, but I thought it would be better. I guess I will go back. It's not because the shirt, it's because I'm using this thing on me where someone said it would be crisper. If the sound is not as good, I'm going to go back to the old way of doing it. I was told that wearing this would, it goes right from this microphone in, but others at the end, let me know, did you find the sound? Just type it in. We're getting close to the end here. The same. A little bit not as good or a little bit better. And then, because someone keeps telling me that he finds it hard to hear me when he listens. I put it on YouTube and it's so loud, I need to turn it down, but I thought I would do something. Is Rabbi Mazuz critical of honorary doctorate as well? I don't know. Good question. The Rashba was a Sephardi and was against philosophy. No, the Rashba was not against philosophy. The Rashba was against studying it too early for the young people. He wasn't against study of medicine and philosophy for people who were of age. The Rush was, but the Rashba, if you were of a certain age and you had background, and was, I mean, obviously he's opposed to heretical views, but he wasn't opposed to Chachma like the Rush was, but he was certainly opposed to people who were not ready for it. All Sephardim were Aristotle? No, he's talking about medieval Sephardim, not later on, yeah. Yes, and of course, when you get into the, in fact, his actual language is, I'll read it to you, Kol HaSfardim HaKadmonim, like I said, all the early Sfardim studied Chachma. Incidentally, even the ones who started studying Kabbalah early on, they didn't see it as in contradiction to philosophy. They saw it as, even the Ramah, who knew Aristotle and he also knew Kabbalah, he thought that they could be brought together. iPad, hasn't Professor Neusner, along with his grad students, translated Talmud Bavli? Neusner translated Talmud Bavli himself, all by himself. And then Yerushalmi, that's what he translated with his graduate students. I don't know how he did it. I know Shaul Lieberman attacked the translation, but still for one person to... do that. No, he translated Yerushalmi by himself and Bavli divided with his students. I believe that's what it is. Unbelievable how he could do that. The Rambam, he did not translate, Neusner never translated the Rambam. The first translation of the Rambam was the Yale University Press. They still haven't done it all. They haven't done yet Ava, Sefer Ava. Recently, Kellner published Mada or vice versa. Kellner did Ava. They're still missing one volume, but they started this in the 50s. In fact, Canon Danby, Herbert Danby, who did the Mishnah, translated one of the volumes of the Rambam. And then Chabad translated it. And it's a good translation, the Chabad. Art Scroll has not translated it. I'm assuming eventually they will. They'll have problems with Sefer Mada, but Satmar holds that they have herd immunity. The problem was that they were doing this before they had herd immunity. Mike says there's an argument that Satmar should have given a seat to someone else since he had told them to stay. I don't know if the Satmar told them to stay by the time he was leaving. He definitely told them to stay beforehand. In the book I mentioned a few times, Olam Moshe Abba, the rabbi there attacks the Satmar Rebbe for telling people to stay. But he did tell them to stay, and then he had a chance to go. But it's not like he couldn't give a seat. The seats were given. Kastner, whatever the reason is, Kastner picked certain people, and if Satmar Rabi wasn't going to take his seat, then Kastner would give it to someone else. It's not like a ticket to a movie theater that the Satmar Rabi could then. It's like a ticket to an airplane today. When I was young, remember, you had a ticket to an airplane, you can give it to someone else. No, today it's your ticket. If you can't go, then the airline takes it back. So, and I'm not defending the Satmar Rebbe, the way he then treated Kastner afterwards or anything like that without publicly thanking him. But to say that he abandoned his flock, especially when the flock wanted him to save himself, I don't see that as a criticism. Shmuley says Satmar wasn't really a Hasidus before the war. Well, I do not agree with that. He had the Satmar Rebbe opened up in Satmar. He functioned as a Rebbe there. He had a yeshiva. He had a tish. He had even though he was young, he had everything that a Rebbe has, and he came. He had the yichus as well. The students of Ramban or Rabbeinu Yonah were against studying philosophy. Yes, but even against studying philosophy, the Rabbeinu Yonah definitely. But you have a dispute between the northern scholars of northern France and southern France. Really, in Provence, they were in line with Catalonia and the whole Sephardic approach. K.K. was a lot more critical than Yusuf Abandon, includes Satmar's whole career. Yes, and with particular attention to behavior in the Kastner train. Yes, that is true. If you read the tablet articles, he's not just dealing with Kastner, he's dealing with everything. That is true. Mike says, I don't buy this theory. All the poskim say it's a chiyuv on all Jewish males to learn Talmud. Where do you see that the poskim say it's a chiyuv on all Jewish males to learn Talmud? And what does that mean, it's a chiyuv on all Jewish males? If you don't know how to learn Talmud, how are you supposed to learn Talmud? Most Jews throughout history never did. But where do you see that it's a chiyuv on all Jewish males to learn Bava Kama and Masechta Zvachim and things like that? That they have to learn that. Look in the Rambam in Yesodei Torah, what he include, where he puts Talmud in. Everyone has to learn, obviously, but who says they have to learn Talmud the way we think of it today? And throughout history, they never did. Treat Agadata as the Ritva treated Trump, not binding. Well, there's a whole tradition in treating it not binding. This goes back to the Gonim, and you see this in the Ramban in his Vikuach, where he says that Agada is like sermons. You can take it or leave it. And that's the whole Rav Avram ben Aramam. There's a whole tradition. Rav Yaakov Kapel Schwartz, I find this interesting, is because we're not in the Rishonic period, and he's writing from a tradition in Satmar, in which is more like a Maharal type of tradition, that all Agadata is binding. It doesn't mean it's all literal, and it doesn't mean that, but that you might have to reinterpret it, but to simply say that we don't hold of it. The problem with this Agada I read you is that you can't really reinterpret it. It's a whole long story there, and it's clear that the Amora, the Moritani treated him poorly, and that's the lesson there. By the way, I'm not saying my theory is correct, but that's how you can explain, I think, certain strange passages where great sages are made to look not so great, which we, if any of us would say it, it's uncomfortable to say that. Okay, so people are saying I faded in and out, and it wasn't bad, not so good. Okay, I'm not going to. Next week, I will be back to the old way of doing things. I gave it a try, and no one else except for the one listener who I appreciate and listening has said, though, that listening on YouTube or on the podcasts, the sound is at all problematic. Yeah, so when the Rambam says 1/3 of your time is spent on Gemara, what do you mean by Gemara? That's the question. And who's he speaking to? Is every single person supposed to do that? The average person never made it beyond Cheder. So yes, if anyone's able to get beyond, if anyone's able to do that, then they're able to. But if they're not able to, the reality is that most people never made it beyond basic education. So maybe you're saying, Mike, though, but in theory, everyone should. But my point is that when anyone who's able to learn Gemara and divide their day, like the Rambam says, he's already part of the elite. they never imagined something where the masses would have an English translation and can sit there and be exposed to it. Anyone who's able to learn Gemara is already part of the elite. So they're able to be brought in to this inner circle. The Rambam also says that the elites are supposed to learn philosophy as well. Is that for the masses? When you reach the level, you're supposed to learn Talmud. That includes Maisa Markava, Maisa Bereshis. That's not for the masses either. That's my only point. That the masses, I think they thought that a lot of the stuff in here is not for the masses. When the masses reach the level that they can learn Gemara, then they're not the masses anymore. Today we have an interesting situation where the masses are learning Gemara. So you tell me, Mike, that the Rambam says you're supposed to spend your time, but that we're not dealing with the masses now. We're dealing with people who already can learn. But just like you're not going to go tell the Rambam says that you're supposed to study included in Gemara, by the way, you have, he's talking about you have to Madama Milsa La Milsa. These are not the masses. That's my point. It's not for the masses. Nat Lewin says that his father had a doctorate from the University of Lvov, but he never attended any class. You had that in Germany also. You had people in Germany who go to university, let's say in Berlin, and then they want to write a doctoral dissertation. They go to Heidelberg and they speak to a professor and they submit it there and 60 pages, and then it's published and they have a doctorate from... next week, Mike, I'll get back to this topic because it's getting late over the Rambam on the chiyuv of you could say of any halacha. And what do I mean? I'll say one more thing about that. I just want to pull up the Rambam and say what I mean, and then we'll end with this. What the Rambam says in the end of chapter 4 in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah is. Better. Let me wait till next week where I can. I'll have it here. I'll start with that next week, and then I'll get to the anti-Zionist letter. By the way, what I'm saying it really has nothing to do with the Rambam, because even if what you're saying is correct, I'm saying what the sages, the Talmud, thought. That's my theory. But I'm going to make the claim that the Rambam does not disagree with this as well. But we'll pick up with that next week. I'll make a note of that, and it's not Das Torah here. It's just a thought I've had over the years about seeing some things. So if you don't accept it, it's okay. With that, I'll see some of you hopefully on Thursday night. But Rabbi Kelman?
Yeah. I've often quoted, by the way, your comment. You've mentioned it a few times on the trips. I know that the Talmud is written by rabbis for rabbis. And like every piece of literature, lawyers write for lawyers, and that's how it works. And that can explain, I think, a little bit on some of the harshness of a language. I mean, you just touched upon, the tip of the iceberg, some of the language in the Talmud. You read it and you want to, like, it's unbelievable. And because of Daf Yomi, correct, now people get to see it. Before, nobody would ever see this.
And the Ben Ish Chai says it's forbidden to translate this into the vernacular because we don't want the masses to see this. There's a whole Satmar polemic against, not just Satmar, because others have written too.
Ramanasha Klein, I think also.
Ramanasha Klein, there's a whole polemic against Art Scroll. And the point of this is that the masses are not supposed to learn Gemara. And I have a whole kuntras, but with all these people writing it, saying that in Europe, we never taught the masses Gemara. That Art Scroll was upslugging the entire system. The masses are supposed to do Mishnayos, simple things. And that this is a dispute in the Haredi or the Hasidic world, because they don't want the masses to have access to it. The Kitzer Shulchan Aruch speaks against, not the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch, the Chayyadim, one of them, speaks against translating works into halachic works into vernacular, because then they won't need the rabbis anymore. But I'll get back to your point, Mike, because I do want to deal with the Rambam that you cite from Yesodei HaTorah. I think it's Berak Gimel, actually, not Dalet Bal. Next week.
I already said it, right? If you can't understand the Mishnah Berurah in the original, you shouldn't be learning it. That's my view. I always think the translation Mishnah Berurah in English, but you can disagree with me.
And I'll just say one thing, Rav Schechter. Someone in my show asked him, he gave a shiur there about 10 years ago. So someone who's big into women's issues said to Rav Schechter, Rebbe, he called him Rebbe, he was very respectful to him. He says, one thing I can't accept, I know you've spoken often that women shouldn't be learning Gemara. I don't accept that. How can you say that? And Rav Schechter says, when did I say only women learned? He says, I don't think men should be learning Gemara.
That is correct. I was in Rosh Hashir for 4 years. And when we asked him once, I remember when I first came to Shir, Shavuimelech Mori said, why do you want to ruin the woman's education? Right now, at least the girls learn the way they learn, you know, Chumash and Machshava. And the boys, their education is destroyed because all they learn is Gemara. The men have to learn everything. The women have to learn. Then if they're on the level, they can also learn Gemara. Rav Schechter often did speak against this sort of... Gemara is not meant for everybody. Yeah, you have to learn all the basics first, and you have to learn Chumash and all that other stuff. Correct.
Obviously, everyone has to learn Gemara. We have to teach our kids because that's the ultimate, and later you'll do that. But the point is, if you're dealing with someone who's 55 years old and has never had a Jewish education, do we teach them what Rav Avadya Yosef says he should learn halacha, not Gemara? So, but I'll get back to this next week with the Rambam.
Listen, intellectual history, that's a whole other interesting discussion. The trends in intellectual history, what they're popular in, maybe 100 years from now, nobody will learn Daf Yomi anymore. Who knows? Maybe everybody will learn. But it's these things go, it took 1900 years for Daf Yomi to become even an idea. They, you know, it never existed for 1900 years. Anyways, Mark, please go. We'll see you on Thursday night.